You know, I was practicing nightly because I have trouble memorizing sometimes, and you have to memorize your whole thing. You don't get to use any sort of prompts or anything. So nightly, I was going over it over and over. And I told him, I said, frankly, I'm getting a little sick of it. And he said, there's nothing wrong with taking a little time off. Just take July off and then get back to it in August. And so even though I'd promised myself I'm going to rehearse this every single night, I took July off. And I was so reinvigorated in the process by the time August rolled around that it was a great lesson in maybe sometimes you just need a little break.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Reframe Podcast. I'm your host, Ana Trujillo-Limon, and today I'm super excited to be joined by my brilliant and multifaceted colleague, Tamsin Butler. Tamsin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So for those of you who don't know Tamsin, she's an award-winning author, she's a TEDx speaker, a military veteran, a fitness professional, Oxford comma enthusiast, and personal finance writer. So we're going to get into some of that, not all of it because we only have 40 minutes, but so I'm really excited to go. So let's get started. So I normally kick off these episodes talking about first money memories, but since we're both writers, I'm curious about your first writing memory. What was the first time you remember like sitting down and really writing something and knowing that you kind of wanted to pursue that?
I remember I wrote a short story in fourth grade and showed it to my teacher, Mrs. Walthall. I still remember her, still my favorite teacher ever. And she liked it so much, she allowed me to read it in front of the whole class. And then she took me aside and she said, you know, you could be a writer. And I was like, I sure could.
Like, that's right.
Yeah, that stuck.
So you were a speaker since you were little too.
Yeah.
So we're going to get into that later, but yeah, for sure. So was there one besides that essay that your teacher saw potential in? Was there something that you've written that's really special to you or significant?
Well, I've written a few books, but my favorite was the Complete Guide to Personal Finance for Teenagers and College Students, because I'm a financial literacy advocate for kids. I feel like it's super important for kids to understand about money.
Oh, for
because
sure.
They're fed so much information that it's hard to distill it down to what they actually need to know and what's actually going to help. So I was really proud of that book for sure.
Yeah. And we'll put a link to that book in the show notes in case y'all want to buy it for some of your clients or any of your kids or people, you know, it's great. So, you know, we've been talking about this in our team meetings a lot, and we love to write. A lot of people love to write, but people also are wanting to copy what other people have already written in different websites. I remember, and this is kind of like in a few years ago when I was an editor, somebody turned in an article, and it was most of it was lifted from another article that had already been published. And when I told the woman about it, she was like, oh, no, I don't see anything wrong with that. And I was just like blown away. So let's talk a little bit about this problem that's kind of resurfacing now and people not really knowing it's an issue. Let's talk about why this is a problem.
Well, there's a misconception that if it's online, it's just up for grabs and you can take it as your own. And that's absolutely not true. A writer went through and wrote that copy. Unless it was done by AI, in which case you don't want it anyhow. But
exactly.
I mean, a writer took the time to pull those words together and they put thought into it. And so scooping that up and then presenting it as your own it's plagiarism, basically. Mm-hmm. Even though it appears online, it's still plagiarism. It's just as bad as copying something out of a book.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's definitely not cool. But there's other types of implications too, right? Not just that morally and legally, it's not good to take somebody else's work, but there are some logistical concerns when it comes to your website and stuff like that. Let's talk about that.
Oh, absolutely. Because a lot of people, what they do is they want to fill their website with copy for SEO, for search engine optimization. They want to get those keywords in there. But when you lift somebody else's copy, it shows up as duplicate content when Google goes through and looking for search engine stuff. And so it can actually hurt you. So it's like a negative search engine optimization. It's like a search engine de-optimization, basically. You're hurting yourself more than you are helping yourself. So it's not just an ethical dilemma. It's also bad for your website's credibility as well.
Oh, yeah. So it's like actually you're paying for it more ways than one than if you do it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about you know, people might be nervous to create their own content. Maybe they're like unsure about their voice or however they're not sure about how to structure it. What advice do you have for people like that?
Well, if you're in a position to create content, like say you're a financial advisor, you have information that people want and you need to trust yourself as a credible authority. Mm-hmm. there's no imposter syndrome with writing, just write. And, you know, I help a lot of partners with their copy. If they write something and they're unsure of it, I kind of finesse it out for them. So it's good to have somebody like that in your corner to kind of help you out with not only making sure that it's proofread, you know, everything's spelled correctly, but that it makes sense and that it's presenting the content as best as you can in a way that's readable to internet readers.
Yeah. One thing that I always, when people ask me like, oh, how can I, you know, I'm nervous about writing, how can I do it? And then they're very good speakers. Like oftentimes I'll encourage them to just hop on a Zoom with just you and record yourself talking about what you want to talk about. And then Zoom creates a transcript and you can just go through and kind of edit it yourself and kind of figure out what you want to write from there. But it's always good to have people like us in your corner, right? Just like you said, you help partners do this type of stuff. But that kind of leads me to my next question, which is tell our listeners a little bit about, you know, what you do here at Carson and kind of the resources that our team, our marketing team has for people joining our ecosystem.
Well, I work on the consumer marketing side. So everything I write is designed for the consumer audience. Every so often, I'll do some advisor stuff when they need me over there. But primarily, I'm consumers facing. So partners who want to write a blog post or who have been asked to compose a guest article somewhere or who just want something as simple as invitations to an event or something like that, I'm the one putting those words together for them. And I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, it's really helpful to have because we have like our coaching arm too does like greeting cards for consumers for them to send out to their clients and then like monthly articles. But that's always really helpful to have because, you know, if you don't, I don't know that it comes naturally to us. It's just that we've practiced a lot over the years. Mm-hmm. But if you're not in practice, it's easier to kind of have somebody else doing that stuff for you. So I love that. So let's kind of hop back to talking about the writing and us as writers. Like, it's super frustrating when you see, like, I wrote this whole series once for a magazine I used to work for about, like, diversity in the outdoor industry. Mm-hmm. And then, like, 2 years after I wrote that whole series, I saw somebody had written it. They took a lot of concepts from my articles and, like, some paragraphs were wholesale, like, on their articles. And I was like, okay, well, the magazine owned the copy and it was the magazine who kind of just reprinted it. So part of me was like, all right, that's legally, that's all right. But like, I was kind of upset, you know? So that's a frustrating thing as a writer to have people copy our work. Has this happened to you before?
It has. I was lucky because at the time that it happened, it was a website that I wrote for that was very into going after people who stole our content. Mm-hmm. So once they realized that somebody had taken my piece verbatim and had claimed it as their own, they sent them a cease and desist. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure what you do, but they sent them something and said, you need to stop using our content. And they stopped. But it just feels very icky when people do that because, I mean, I spent the time to pull that together. That's my writing. Exactly. And so for somebody else to say, oh, this is my writing, it feels so wrong. And just, like I said, icky.
Yeah. And then there's also ways around that too. It's like, if you like something somebody has written, you could paraphrase it and then give an attribution in the text and kind of use some endnotes and stuff. So it is really okay if you want to kind of use elements of a writer's work so long as you give them credit. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, like if somebody says something so succinctly and beautifully that you don't want to change it, but that's the message you want to get across, like say perhaps a poem or something, mm-hmm. that's okay to reach out to that content creator and say, hey, I really like this. I think it would really accentuate my piece. Can I put a portion of this in there and, you know, give you attribution? And 9 times out of 10, they're going to say yes, as long as they own the copy at that point. Sometimes it's gone to the website. So
yeah. And in that case, you could ask the publication, like when I was an editor of a publication, like people would ask us all the time, like, hey, can we republish this with attribution? And of course, and I never told anybody no. We never told anybody no. So right. Yeah, you just give credit where credit's due. That's just the bottom line, right?
Absolutely. But on the same vein, don't be afraid to create your own content.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that's where I think a lot of people in our industry, we're going to get into speaking next, but a lot of people in our industry are very really great speakers and they kind of get their points across. Like, you know, you see people on social doing videos and things like that. And so again, that's where I go back to that. Record yourself talking because like that will also add that conversational tone to whatever it is that you want to write. So that's great. So speaking of talking, you know, a lot of people in our industry do like the speaking circuit for the conferences and things like that. And people want to be better at that and kind of build their brand. And you recently did a TEDx Omaha talk. So let's talk a little bit about that. What inspired you to do that? And what was kind of the message of your talk?
Well, my talk was an argument against the societal assertion that authenticity is necessary for success. Mm-hmm. And it kind of delves into, is authenticity who you are or who you want to be, basically. So that was my talk. And I just come from a place where I've led a very interesting life, and I've kind of formed this idea that you can kind of be whoever you want to be. And so that's where the talk came from.
Oh, that's super interesting. So like, tell me a little bit about the TEDx, why you chose TEDx and went that route.
I just happened to see that they had a call for speakers out last year. And I thought to myself, I should probably do a TEDx talk. And so I applied and managed to get through to the audition process. And it's a wonderful experience. And I suggest it for anybody, truly.
Do you know when that recording is going to be ready? Because I know the recording should be up soon, right?
In about a month, I think.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, so if that's, we'll put that in the show notes too when that's ready, because I really want to see it. You did a practice run with our team, and I had another meeting scheduled at that time, so I was super bummed out. But let's talk a little bit. I'm always curious about the difference between like the TED Talks and TEDx Talks. Can you dive into that a little bit?
TEDx is independent or independently organized TED Talks that are local or regional. Like we have TEDx Omaha. There's a TEDx Des Moines, you know, major cities tend to have their TEDx there. Mm-hmm. So it's a TED Talk, but it's a regional based one, yeah, not on the big TED stage.
Awesome. Yeah, and they're great too. We had the TEDx Cherry Creek here outside of Denver. That one was really fun. I went with a partner, Alexa. We got tickets to last year's TEDx talk, and every single speaker was just so great and so insightful. And we actually had a few of those speakers from that event on the show over the years. So that was really great. So tell me a little bit about the process. Like, you know, people, since those are independently owned, we have partners all over the country, people might want to respond when they see one of those calls, just like you did. So tell us a little bit about the process.
Well, I can only speak on the TEDx Omaha process, but I imagine that it's similar at the other TEDx's. But what you do first is you have to fill out an application online, which also includes about a 2 to 3 minute video talking about your idea. And the thing about it is that you can't just say, I want to do a TEDx talk. You have to say, here's my idea worth spreading. So it's a matter of filling out the application and then doing the video as well. And then you wait a while they deliberate, because they get quite a few applications from what I understand. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you go through an audition process, which was via Zoom for me. And so you speak to some of the TEDx leadership, and they just ask you questions about your topic. And then they go back and deliberate again. And then if you're accepted, you enter the cohort, and then it becomes a pretty great journey where you meet up about once a month with your fellow TED Talkers, and you all kind of go through the journey together, and you're assigned a speaker coach, and the speaker coach helps you through it all as well.
What was the most interesting thing you learned from your speaker coach?
Part of being a great fiduciary is helping your clients understand their full financial picture, and it should be no different for your life. Do you know what your business is worth? Get your firm valuation today with our free valuation calculator. Whether you're looking to share equity with your team, buy another firm, prepare for an exit, or just simply want to see the market value of your business, visit carsongroup.com/valuation to get started.
You know, I was practicing nightly because I have trouble memorizing sometimes, and you have to memorize your whole thing. You don't get to use any sort of prompts or anything. So nightly, I was going over it over and over. And I told him, I said, frankly, I'm getting a little sick of it. And he said, there's nothing wrong with taking a little time off. Just take July off and then get back to it in August. And so even though I'd promised myself I'm going to rehearse this every single night, I took July off. And I was so reinvigorated in the process by the time August rolled around that it was a great lesson in maybe sometimes you just need a little break.
Yeah. No, that's valid too. Like last night I was writing an article for the Journal of Financial Planning, and I was just like having a hard time kind of getting everything down. And even though it's a smaller version of what you just described, I'm like, you know what, let me take a break, let me cook some dinner, and then I'll come back to it. And then when I came back to it, it's like, oh, okay, that's what I wanted to write. There it is. So that's like, I love that. That's a great point. So I understand you're you know, talking to a few partners who want to do this type of speaking also. Mm-hmm. So what advice do you have for them and people who want to kind of become TEDx speakers?
You have to distill down what your idea worth spreading is. It can't just be, hey, I deserve to be on the TEDx talk stage because I know things or whatever. You have to have an idea that's worth spreading out into the world. And so once you get that idea figured out, you then have to figure out why you're the person to spread the idea. Once you get those things down, your application is probably a lot more solid at that point because, you know, you have the tangible idea that's worth spreading and you can justify why you're the one who should spread it. And I'd also say that they're not necessarily looking for people who have gobs and gobs of speaking experience. That's why you get the speaker coach. Luckily, I had some speaking experience already, so I wasn't too worried about it. But they're not looking for somebody who's going to come in with a polished presentation. Mm-hmm. It gets polished eventually. You're not going into it with a polished presentation right off the bat.
That's really helpful to know.
Yeah.
And I'm also curious about your perspective on things like, you know, writing blog posts, writing articles, and doing the speaking events specifically for our advisors. Why is that helpful in kind of building their brand and building trust among clients and prospects?
Well, all those things lend a lot of credibility. And the more you're seen, the more the people around you build up what's called a parasocial relationship with you or parasocial interaction, mm-hmm. where the brain is kind of fooled. And I'm not telling you to fool people, but I'm saying that the brain gets kind of fooled when it gets exposed to a person's face to where it feels like, oh, I know this person. Mm-hmm. And then automatically they give you a little more credibility and a little more trust. Because when you are walking down the street and you run into a face you know, you automatically feel more comfortable unless there's some sort of, you know, torrid backstory or something. But it's a neurological reaction where once you see somebody's face several times, your brain is kind of convinced, oh, I know that person. And that's what you want with clients. You want them to feel like they know you. And so doing blog posts, getting your face out there, doing different talks and speeches and videos are fantastic. That sort of thing can help cultivate those relationships from afar.
Yeah, that's excellent. Those are excellent points. And the video stuff too, like I've noticed on Facebook, like on not Facebook, LinkedIn, for the coaching team, we do these like video interviews and we do coach tip videos. And those are usually the posts that more people interact with. There's more engagement on those posts. I guess this might be a silly question, but why is video kind of more, people tend to interact with that and engage with that a little bit more?
Video is easy. It's so much easier to consume video than it is to consume words. It's a simple thing. I mean, watching a video takes very little effort and you consume a lot of information just from watching it. And so I don't have the statistics, but at one point I know videos were performing so much better than any other content out there on social media. I don't know if that's still the case, but it certainly was at one point. That's because people just enjoy consuming it. It's easy.
Yeah, it is. And one thing we were talking about in another team meeting, I'm not sure if you were there, but like the subtitles and the captions too, like even though you're consuming the text, but when you do it on a video, somehow it seems easier when you're just reading the closed captions. Like if you have it on mute or you're not listening to sound, it's easier to consume that text while it's a video and there's a person talking. I don't know what psychological tricks you might know about that's
I will say about. That just along that same vein, that subtitles should always be used for ADA compliance, mm-hmm. so that people can access the content if they have trouble, you know, not like some people they can hear, but they can't perceive, if that makes sense. And some mm-hmm. people simply can't hear very well. So the subtitles help. And subtitles can also help with search engine optimization as well. So it's a win-win for sure.
Very cool. So are there some programs that you've worked with that have been helpful that, you know, make higher quality and better subtitles? Because I know like LinkedIn comes with a automatically subtitles are added, but they're not always right and they don't look that great. So is there like a title, some sort of software or something that you have used that you've had success with in the past?
I don't really have one to recommend off the top of my head.
Okay.
You know, I'd say that even bad subtitles are better than no subtitles though. So if you're just using the, you know, the stuff that's generated by LinkedIn, that's better than not using it at all.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, when people listen to this, I always like to provide or have our guests provide some takeaways and some tangible takeaways for folks. So people who are listening to this, what are some things when it comes to copywriting and speaking and kind of building your brand that they can implement right away? Like as soon as they listen to this episode, they can go back to their office and kind of get started.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say I had an acting coach years ago who gave me some excellent advice. He says, seek out rejection daily because then you never know what you're not going to get rejected in. So when it comes to asking to speak somewhere or asking to have something published, I mean, don't be afraid to do those things. The worst they're going to say is no. And what does that matter really in the grand scheme of things? So especially advisors have so much knowledge that people want and people need, and they should be ready and willing to give out that information via, you know, copy, video, speaking. People want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, for sure. And some of the partners that you work with or some of the advisors you've seen, who are some folks to follow, like that do some really great copy or do some really great writing, in your opinion?
Well, I have to say that Larry Sprung does the best with parasocial interactions. I've even told him that before, that, you know, nobody does it like him. I mean, you see his posts, you immediately know who he is, what he does, and you know he's going to be at a hockey rink, you know?
Right.
So I think he is one to follow for sure with that sort of thing. Absolutely.
For sure. And then that, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, that was it. Yeah.
Oh no. But then you always know, you see Larry and automatically think joy. Like what am I doing that's bringing me joy? Right. Like,
exactly.
So that, there's that thing that Larry has built that into his brand. Like I think he even trademarked it, right? What did you do today that brought you joy?
Yeah, no, I love what he's doing on social media. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, no, he's doing great. So yes, definitely follow Larry Sprung. He's everywhere. Midland Financial. He does really good work on social and produces really great videos. And he even has his own podcast, of course. Mm-hmm. So I guess the thing that I also wanted to know, what are, I guess, the books? I love to read. We both love to read. I guess as creatives, right, we always have our nose in a book. What are some books that have helped you with your writing over the years that you recommend to advisors?
Stephen King wrote a nonfiction book called On Writing, mm-hmm. that you wouldn't think Stephen King would be like the best to give advice on writing anything other than horror. But that book absolutely changed the way I wrote. It was fantastic. I advise it. Anybody who wants to write should read that book from Stephen King.
It's funny that Stephen King came up in that after that question, in the answer to that question, because I had a writing coach many, many years ago, and I was fresh out of college, you know, like, you know, when you're fresh out of college, you don't know anything and you're not a great writer. But she's like, you need to start reading Stephen King. And she eventually recommended that book, but she just in general told me to start reading Stephen King. So I'm like, you know, my 20s, I'm single, I live alone, I'm having my, you know, scaring the bejesus out of myself every night with all these Stephen King books. But I found he's a brilliant writer in his own right. Like, even if it's horror, if you're not into horror, just for the mechanics of it all and the descriptions and all of this stuff, Stephen King's just a great person to study for all of that.
Yeah. And his nonfiction book On Writing doesn't just delve into, you know, how to write, but it talks about his process, his creative process. Mm-hmm. And it's just fascinating to hear how he thought of some of his stuff. It's just the littlest thing that he saw set him off into this world of these stories. And I love it. It's amazing.
So tell us about your process. Your writing process.
Well, when it comes to fiction, I have a very similar process where I'll see something and it'll prompt questions. I used to teach creative writing for a nonprofit, and I would tell people, I'd say, look around the room, now find something. And what if something happened to that thing? Tell me what's happening right now. What if the door opens? Who walks through? You know, what if the window crashes? Why did it crash? You know, so that's kind of where I go with my fiction. With my nonfiction and my writing here, it's basically, I kind of just have it down to a formula at this point where, you know, I consider the reader always, you know, what does the reader need to know? What does the reader want to know? Not what do I want to tell them? I say, what do they need to get out of this? And I try to distill it down to that.
No, oh, that's valuable. What does the reader need to know? And that's really good. And that's a great advice for y'all creating some copy out there, is to always keep that in mind, right? Because I tend to sometimes, that's my downfall, is I'm like, what do I want to say? And then I'll kind of go on and on. I'm curious about your process in terms of scheduling. Do you have like a specific block where you write, whether it's your fiction or your nonfiction stuff? Do you use like a time blocking technique or something like that?
It's more just when inspiration hits when it comes to fiction. I don't write that much fiction anymore, but, you know, here I'm a powerhouse of copy. I just write all day and I love it. So it's mostly, you know, what am I going to write? 8 hours worth of writing.
Yeah. I love it. Right. During work hours, the Tamsin's at it.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, so Tamsin, this has been so much fun, and I've learned so much from you in our team meetings that we're able to have, that we've had all the creatives kind of connect at Carson. That's been one of the highlights of my year this year. So is there anything that I didn't ask that you'd like our listeners to know?
I will say one thing, and then when we're talking about partners creating copy, if they're wondering what they should write about, the question is answered with the questions they're asked, mm-hmm. because they know what people want to know because they're asked those questions all the time. What questions are you frequently asked, and what questions are you most qualified to answer? So if you're wondering, what should I write a blog post about? I'd say, what are your clients asking you? And then just answer the question.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's because it is. And then it makes it easier on you as the advisor. Like if you have multiple clients asking you these questions, you write a blog post or a newsletter, whatever, addressing mm-hmm. it, and then they'll develop better, like not better, but more in-depth questions based on their own unique situation for you. So that's, yeah. Love that advice.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
So Tamsin, for people who are listening and want to connect with you, where's the best place to do that? The best place to follow and connect with you?
All my social medias are my name. So that's a benefit of having a unique first name, is everything's at Tamsin Butler. So whatever social media people are on, they can find me on there. And of course, if they're partners, they can just reach out to me directly here at for Carson.
Sure. So I know I said I was done with the questions, but you said your name is unique. Let's talk. Tell me about the origin story of your name.
Tamsin is the feminine form of Thomas and is super common in England, from what I understand. Uh-huh. And my parents kind of fashion themselves Anglophiles. So okay. They'll tell you, you know, God save the king and all that, though they've never been over there. But so anything of English descent, they love it. So that's how I got named Tamsin.
Okay, great. I love to hear people's name stories. And the funny thing is, so my mom, when she was pregnant with me, thought I was a boy. And so she mm-hmm. named me Thomas Andrew. And then when I was born, she was like, oh, okay, well, just pick a grandma's name and slap it on me. No, Tamsin, this has been so much fun. And I always like to end with a question. What does finding your freedom mean to you?
It means being confident in setting my goals and going forth towards those goals.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Love it. Thanks. All right, Tamsin, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning into this week's episode. Please subscribe so you never miss another one.